Mr. DeMille. I'm ready for my close-up.
I'll show up sometime. See me.
Aiden Bond! Top of the world!
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night, sir.
The stuff that dreams are made of.
Hi, Wendy here. Before we start off our episode today, I want to remind everybody to check us out on social media, Facebook, Twitter, and TikTok. Also, please leave a rating or comment on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. You can find us on social media by simply searching Silver Screen Time Machine, and please make sure you follow our podcast, Silver Screen Time Machine, anywhere you get your podcast. Thank you and enjoy the episode. Hello, and welcome again to Silver Screen Time Machine, Wendy's Classic Film Review. Today we have our guest, Debbie. Hello, Debbie. Welcome.
Hello, Wendy. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. So, Debbie, we are getting in our time machine, and we are going back to when?
1955.
And we are going to talk about what?
We're No Angels.
As a matter of fact, today is our Christmas special.
That's right. Happy holidays, yeah. Wendy.
When we release this, it will be Christmas. So I hope is having a lovely Christmas out there. And this is not, when you're thinking of your Christmas movies, this is not your first movie you think of.
Definitely not. I actually have never heard of this movie until like a couple years ago. My aunt told me about it. She had actually got a DVD, like she bought DVDs off of Turner Classic Movies website. She's like, you need to watch this. And I was like, okay, you know, I'll get to it. And I never did. And you told me you were going to talk about this. And I was like, well, now's the time. And this was certainly one I'd never heard of before, but I planned to tell everybody about.
Yeah. For some reason, this movie is the sort of movie that gets put on the back shelf and forgotten about because my parents gave this to me for Christmas one year, I think. And I took a look at it and I was like, eh. And I just kind of threw it on my shelf like, okay.
It's like, yeah, nobody's talking about it. It must not be that good.
Yeah, I was like, I don't know. I don't really know if I care about this. I don't know what this is about. And
right.
Then one day I'm like, well, I just picked it up and started watching it. And I was like, oh, what the heck? You know, why have I never seen this before? It's absolutely delightful. But Debbie, I don't know if you want to tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, not much to talk about. Well, no, you and I helped put the Pittsburgh Classic Movie Club together in 2019.
Yep.
I've been a huge classic film fan my whole life. I guess it was probably through the Christmas musicals and musicals itself that I was introduced. And as I got a little bit older, I got into classic film. And I love to talk about it. So
Christmas films are so nice because they just give you that nice heartwarming feeling. And this film is no different. This is a Christmas film, despite the fact that you have people in there that maybe you wouldn't consider being Christmas film stars.
Right. And the story itself, it's one of those stories where, like, if you took Christmas out of it, I don't think it would work as well.
No.
It has to be during Christmas that it happens.
And I mean, I think you can call this a black Christmas story.
It's referred to as a dark comedy, and that's what it is.
Yes.
And honestly, it's like the thing about Christmas movies, yes, they're warm and loving, but sometimes it can be a little bit too much. And you're just kind of like, okay, I'm worn out. But this movie, I think, is a wonderful balance between the schmaltziness and then, like, the darker stuff.
You get your, like, sugary saccharineness of Frank Capra, although even he has a dark side in It's a Wonderful Life, to
be honest.
He's not completely saccharine, but we're not talking about It's a Wonderful Life, which is such a common Christmas. We want to talk about an obscure Christmas movie that everybody should get a chance to see.
Absolutely.
And directed by someone you would not expect to be directing a Christmas movie, at least not in my mind, Michael Curtiz.
Right. I was shocked when I saw that, too. I thought, oh, that's interesting. But I brought along with me, TCM released a book, Christmas in the Movies, 30 Classics to Celebrate the Season by Jeremy Arnold. And it actually has We're No Angels in here.
Oh.
And it talked about that. It talked about they picked him to direct this movie right after he had started White Christmas. And at the time, nobody even knew that that was going to be the hit that it was. So it ended up actually working out, really.
Yeah, and although you think of Michael Curtiz as somebody who does a lot of serious movies, I think everybody sort of thinks of him for Casablanca. I mean, that's the first thing people think of it. He was nominated for 5 Oscars. And I thought it was really interesting because one of his Oscar nominations, he wasn't even on the ballot. He was written in. It was for Captain Blood.
Oh,
so actually people wrote him in and he came in second place.
Oh, that's
just
interesting.
On write-in votes. So that's how much I guess people like Captain Blood. But he also did, you know, he did musicals. He did Yankee Doodle Dandy. He did also lighthearted films, The Adventures of Robin Hood.
Right.
And it's sort
I
of like
surprised
you always,
at that too.
Yeah, you always consider him with serious films.
Mm.
And he was, I think, maybe because he was such a serious guy. I think that's what it is. Very focused, maybe not especially the nicest fellow out there. He didn't like to take lunches because he thought it made him tired afterwards. So he also didn't think that anybody else should take a lunch.
I work with quite a few people who feel the same.
So yeah, see, he was a bit of a difficult director to deal with. I read that.
Oh,
so funny. He once got hurt falling out of a moving car because he wanted to write down an idea. And you would think, well, how did he get hurt doing that? But the fact was that he was the driver.
Oh my God. Well, he's definitely dedicated. You can't say otherwise.
And actually, I thought it was interesting that they said that he was credited with discovering Doris Day. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
He said he heard her sing at a Hollywood party, and he was going to direct a film called Romance on the High Seas, 1948. Mm-hmm. And Betty Hutton, who he was supposed to be using, had just become pregnant, and she had to back out of the film. And he was looking for an actress to replace her, and he saw Doris Day, and that's what started Doris's Day career.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yes. Michael Curtiz, he worked on Casablanca with Humphrey Bogart, and he works here with Humphrey Bogart as well. And another person you don't really expect to see in a funny Christmas movie.
You know, that is true. Like, when you think of comedy, you don't think of Humphrey Bogart.
No.
But at the same time, one of the things that I love about Casablanca is the comedy in it.
Yeah.
And despite him not being a comedic actor, he still can pull off comedic lines very well. In Casablanca, I love whenever he's talking to the German soldiers and he's looking over their dossier of him or something like that. And he says, are my eyes really brown? And he says it's serious, but it's comedic and it works. It didn't surprise me at all that as I continued to watch this film, I was like, okay, it's not a surprise to me that they chose him for this because it suits him.
Yeah, it's nice to see him doing something maybe a little bit against type as well. I mean, even when he had these funny parts in certain films like Sabrina or even The African Queen, there were funny parts in that too.
Right.
These were still all very serious kind of roles, you know, not especially lighthearted roles. But this, it's nice to see him doing something against type, which is always, I like to see that with actors. The screenplay was written by Ranald McDougall, which sounds very Scottish.
But maybe it's Ranald.
Ranald. Yes, my pronunciation is. I have to make an announcement now on the podcast because I got screamed at by 1,000 people.
Oh, gosh.
Well, that's not even true because not 1,000 people listen to my podcast, but by the 20 people that listen to my podcast, that I said Buddy Ebsen's name wrong. I called him Buddy Epstein, unfortunately. My apologies to everybody. I said his name wrong. Please don't come for me anymore. Anyhow, this fellow, Ranald, is that what you say?
I would say it's Ranald.
Ranald McDougall. He wrote the screenplay. He was nominated for an Oscar for his work on Mildred Pierce, which is another Michael Curtiz film.
Right.
I mean, he's also known for writing screenplay for Cleopatra. This film was based on a play, My Three Angels, by Samuel and Bella Sipwack, who are not credited at all. And I think they're not credited because they based their play on another play.
On the French play.
Which is a French play by Albert Husson. Husson?
I would say that's how that's pronounced. That's Husson? How I read it when I, yeah.
Who is credited. So unfortunately, Samuel and Bella didn't get their credit. But they were Oscar nominated for Best Original Story for the film My Favorite Wife, which is a really cute film.
That is a great movie.
Yeah. Producer is Pat Dugan. He's kind of only produced like a handful of films. I've never heard of him.
Neither have I.
And these films that he produced, I've not heard of. And I don't confess to know every film in the world, but
yeah,
The Young Savages, The Vagabond King, and Red Garters.
Oh, yeah.
I think literally he produced 5 films. It was
wow.
So strange, but this was one of the ones. So good job on this.
Right. It's a good one. Yeah.
This is a good one.
Good choice.
When you're producing one of your 5 films and you have Michael Curtiz as your director, Humphrey Bogart as your actor, you know, that's pretty impressive. The music or score by Frederick Holiander, what score? Literally, there's hardly any music in this film.
Right.
There are some parts when they have a little, really sentimental scene that there's a little bit of sentimental music in, but it's very quiet.
I was going to say, the song that the wife performs, Amelie, it's called Sentimental Moments.
Yep.
And then they, of course, sing The Three Angels, But yeah, I will say the score is one of the few things that I didn't really notice in this. There's so much
because it's really not, there's nothing.
Right.
It's hardly there. But this fellow actually is a 4-time Oscar nominee. And he did one of a film that I really like, Talk of the Town, Born Yesterday and Christmas in Connecticut, another Christmas film. So he was, an expert at Christmas
there
films,
you go.
I guess. Our cinematographer is Loyal Giggs. What a name, Loyal. This fellow is a 5-time Oscar nominee, and he won Best Cinematography again for a really great film, Shane.
That is a great
one. And he also won an honorary Oscar for special photography and sound effects in Spawn of the North, which was, I guess, a production team win. I've never heard of that, but apparently they had a whole production team win an honorary Oscar. I guess the photography and the sound effects in Spawn of the North were incredibly great. I don't know. But he's also known for The Ten Commandments, The Greatest Story Ever Told. This is shot in VistaVision and Technicolor. Very pretty.
Gorgeous film. I was not expecting that. I expected this to be like more grittier looking. But as I kept watching my repeated viewings, I couldn't help but just notice everything in the background, the coloring.
The color was very nice.
So gorgeous. So gorgeous.
I mean, my complaint with it, and I guess I'm going to get to the people that I'm going to complain about, is our art director or our set director, one or the other, because these clearly look like sets.
True.
They don't even look like especially great sets. There's a point in the time when they're on the roof and they're going from all these skylights to windows, and there's just this big open space where a roof or something should be. And I'm like, okay, what is that space? And then you look down, there's a room down there. It's like, okay, so when it rains, does...
I'm really glad you're pointing this out because I never even bothered to notice that.
I mean,
it was freaking me out that they were sitting on the roof, looking
down, like
just paying attention.
Them.
Yeah, just like
spying
that,
on them. Every time they go to a different room, they'd run to a different window.
Like, oh, what's going on now?
Yeah, it's a little silly, a lot of it. But I can't fuss too much about these sort of things because it's a Christmas film. And it's not meant to be uber realistic or anything. And these people, the art directors, Roland Anderson and Hal Pereira, we actually just talked about, they did Breakfast at Tiffany's. Mm. They have 15 and 23 Oscar nominations, respectively. So I don't think we can fault them.
Right.
The set decorator has Sam Comer as a 4-time Oscar winner, and he has 22 nominations. So I don't think we can talk too much about them. And he did win the Oscar for Sunset Boulevard and The Rose Tattoo. And I keep having this film, The Rose Tattoo, come up. And I'm like, I have to see this film because I'll be talking about these different production crew. We talked about The Sweet Smell of Success, the cinematographer on that. And he also won for The Rose Tattoo. And I keep seeing this come up and I'm like, I got to see this film.
I know.
What is this?
I'm kind of curious myself now.
But anyhow, we're not here to talk about The Rose Tattoo. Editor Arthur Smith, he's also a 2-time Oscar nominee for Sayonara and again Sunset Boulevard. He also did Sabrina and Some Like It Hot. And lastly, I thought we should give a shout out to the costume designer because we are in period clothing. Late 1800s.
Yeah, it's specifically 1895, which is another thing I was not expecting. I just thought it was going to be random town, random
they were very
year
specific about
around.
It.
But they're very specific that it's 1895.
So the costume designer was Mary Grant. All I really saw that she was known for The Sweet Smell of Success, which certainly is a completely different kind of attire.
You know, though, it's something that I kind of want to look into if that was the right prison clothes. Because I was like, their prison clothes, I've never seen anything like that before. And it really kind of makes me want to look into that era and that particular place to find out if that is really what their prison outfits look like.
Yeah, I'm not a clothing expert. I'm pretty good eye for clothing of different eras. I felt like the dresses they had them in were closer to like early 1900s, the sort of dresses they were wearing in Meet Me in St. Louis, which was set in like, what, 1903?
That was early 1900s, 1903.
Yeah, whenever the World Fair was, that's when it was set. So, which I don't know offhand.
Pretty sure it's 1903.
Yeah. I thought it was, but so that strikes me more on the early 1900s, but maybe there was not much of a change between, who knows.
Right.
Anyhow, who are we to criticize her? We don't really know. That's my comments on the crew. We'll talk about our actors we have in this film. So we've already mentioned Humphrey Bogart. Peter Ustinov, I love.
I love him too.
A great, great actor. A 2-time Academy Award winner. 2 times.
Yes.
He won for Spartacus and Taupe Canny. Do you know how to say that one? I don't know that.
I'm not really sure myself.
Oh, I'm sorry. Top Cappy.
Top Cappy.
It's a film, but it's T-O-P-K-A-P-I. I could be saying it wrong. So he's wonderful. He's a great, great actor.
I've always been a huge Peter Ustinov fan.
Yeah, he's so good. He's really good in that Roman film that I don't like to try to say the name of.
Because, with Deborah Carr, Quo Vadis.
Yes, yes, yep. Thank you. Thank you for saying it.
Yep.
Yes, I know it. I know how to look at it phonetically, but I don't know how to say it. And then, you know, you have Aldo Ray, who's just so cute in these kind of roles.
So I'm going to be honest, and Isabel, Gloria Talbot.
Yeah.
They were the only two who I wasn't quite aware of their filmography, but I think he was my favorite.
Like, he's adorable.
He was such a delight yes. in this role. Perfect. When I saw that it was the three of them, Humphrey Bogart, Peter Ustinov, Aldo Ray, I thought, oh, that's an odd grouping. Like, how is that going to work? And it works.
Yes.
It's perfect. It makes me sad. I kind of wish there would have been a series of movies surrounding these guys, because I would have watched that. Any other situation with them, I would have loved to see a movie with them in prison together. I just thought the three of them worked so well.
Yeah, they're adorable. Aldo Ray is known for playing this kind of dopey character. He does it really, really well. Maybe a little bit of a one-note type actor. Don't know that he has all the chops. You know, he was supposed to be the lead in From Here to Eternity. He was supposed to have Montgomery Clift's part.
No, he was supposed to play Pruitt. That would not have been the same. As much as I liked him in this, Montgomery Clift was good.
I've seen him in several things, and he does tend to play this kind of dopey persona a lot, this kind of dumb, cute persona. He's very charming. He's very handsome. He has a really interesting voice.
I did recognize him. He did a voice for a minor character in The Secret of Nim. I heard his voice and I was like, I know that voice.
Yeah, his voice is very distinctive.
And I realized he was a minor character in that movie.
We also have in this film another great English actor, Basil Rathbone, which is, you know.
Which was another surprise for me. I was not expecting that either, yeah.
Mostly from Sherlock Holmes fame. He's really known for Sherlock Holmes. He was also in The Adventures of Robin Hood as well. Another two-time Oscar nominee. Joan Bennett as well plays the wife, Amelie.
I look at it as Amelie, but the way Leo G. Carroll pronounced it sounded like Emily.
He did sound like Emily.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Leo G. Carroll.
I enjoy him too. I was happy to see him in this. It's like his part seemed very small. It seemed like Joan Bennett was a little bit more prominent than him. But yeah, I enjoyed him.
He kind of plays the absent-minded, confused husband. Is my daughter here? Do I have a daughter?
I don't know. Yeah.
And he's very comical in that way. But when I was reading his thing, it looks like he plays a lot of spies to me. He was in North by Northwest. He was in Strangers on a Train.
Right.
Just little roles here and there.
Right.
But anyhow, let's get a little bit into the plot. So we start out with, well, it tells you the year, and then you see, again, these sets, which, but okay. You see these guys sort of sneaking around, these three guys.
I have to admit, that first opening shot, while it to anybody else probably seemed really boring, it kind of drew me in.
Did it?
Yeah, because, you know, it starts off with a star, and you're immediately like, okay, Star of Bethlehem kind of thing. Then you see a guy with a donkey singing a French song, which also lured me in. And then you see the three of them just sneaking around in the background. And it was just like, oh, okay. I know it's silly, but to me, that opening shot just drew me in
so
much.
It's going to draw a lot of parallels with the nativity and
Three wise men,
the star of, you know, like you said, the Star of Bethlehem, all these things. It's drawing a lot of parallels there. Apparently, they're on this place called Devil's Island, which is French.
Guiana.
French.
I looked up that one. Yeah, I gotta look up that one.
And this was a real place. This was a penal colony of Cayenne. And it's a French penal colony that operated for 100 years from 1852 to 1952 and officially closed in 1953. So this is a real place. I mean, they're not there, obviously. We just already said that they're definitely not there.
Yeah, it's definitely
set. But it's set in a realistic place. We find that they've escaped from their prison somehow or another, and they're sort of blending in with all the other convicts that, you know, I guess these other convicts have like a work release or they're going to work on the in the areas, I guess.
Right. I was a little confused by that at first, too. It took a couple, like the second or third viewing for me to be like, oh, okay, I guess these particular prisoners can come and go.
They have a work release and they go and work, I gather. We get the impression that they're waiting for the ship. They're going to try to sneak onto the ship and escape. And in the meantime, they need to sort of go around and forage for food, supplies, stuff like that. So they go into this fellow's shop.
Felix Ducatel.
Ducatel, yes.
Yes.
Monsieur Ducatel, yes. So anyhow, they go into his shop and nobody's there. Fellow is so absent-minded. Like, he's not very mindful of his shop.
Another quick comment. I love when they first go in, they immediately just start taking things. But it's no wonder because no one's there.
No one's there.
You could easily just walk in, grab a handful of stuff and just leave.
Yeah, nobody's tending the shop at all. So eventually, he comes out and talking to them and so forth. And they say, hey, you've got a leak in your roof. We can help you fix the roof. And he says, yeah, go for it. Go ahead. You know, why not just let free convicts hang around? No problem.
You know,
no reason to be worried. I have a daughter and wife. That's okay. You know, go ahead up on the roof. So they go up on the roof and then that's when they start doing the spying bit.
They don't fix anything.
They just spy on the roof. And then the wife comes home and they're talking about their troubles. And we find out that the business is in trouble. And this cousin Andre is apparently in charge. He owns the business and he's just running it from him. And then we already get this impression that this cousin Andre is not a very nice fellow. And we get all this information. Then we find out that the daughter has this crush on the
It's Andre's nephew.
Yeah.
Andre is Felix's cousin.
So what is, yeah, we don't know.
I don't know if I want to figure out.
It's a confusing relationship. But
it's like,
In some way, he's distantly related to this girl, I would guess. Unless it's a marriage or something. I don't know. Anyhow, we're confused. But anyhow, Isabel has a crush on Paul and she wants to marry him. And then we find out that they are coming, that he receives this letter. They're on their way. And of course, Felix is very worried because the store is not in order. The accounts are not in order. The store's lost all this money. And so he's terrified of this guy coming. But the girl is really excited because she thinks, oh, Paul's coming, la, la, la. But then she reads on more in the letter and it says later on in the letter that he is going to be engaged to this wealthy ship builder's daughter or something.
Paul is going to be engaged and she is so heartbroken that she faints immediately.
So of course the guys have to run down and,
and the guys are there watching, so.
Yes, they're all spying. And we get the impression that Aldo Ray's character, which what is his name,
Albert
is a bit of a rapist,
right?
We get the impression that he's done something, sexually assaulted a woman in some way.
They establish in the opening, like the second scene, he begins to chase after any particular woman in a skirt and they have to grab him.
Yes.
So immediately you're kind of filled with terror, like, oh, he's near that young girl.
Yes.
Oh, maybe get her away from him.
And then his first suggestion is, when they faint, you're supposed to loosen their clothing.
Yeah.
And then Jules is Peter Ustinov and Joseph is Humphrey Bogart. They're both like, no, you get away. You know, we'll take care of it. But then they wind up having him carry her into the bedroom.
Yeah, he's the one. I guess he's the strength out of all of them. And he's the one that carries. And I love the scene where Emily tells him to take her into her room and Humphrey Bogart just goes to Jules and or Peter Ustinov and is just like, you better go with him.
Yeah. And I mean, the whole time I just think Peter Ustinov is just so good in every reaction he does. He's very comical. The only thing that kind of grates on me slightly is this convict having this very upper crust sounding British accent.
That is true.
Very good diction, perfect diction.
That is true. That was one of the things that threw me off a little bit about his character.
Yeah.
But he was so good with his body language and his facial expressions that I still believe that he was a crook.
Yes, he's excellent. He's an excellent actor.
Absolutely.
He supposedly murdered his wife. We find out later he murdered his wife for cheating on him.
Yes.
And then he says it was all his fault because he came home.
He didn't write to her that he was coming.
He didn't tell her he was coming so that she could not be involved with somebody when he showed up. But anyhow, that's later on in the film. So Albert carries her to her room and you know, they tend to her or whatever. And then at first the mother, Emily, whatever her name is, the mother, Joan Bennett, she's not really happy about having these convicts.
She's concerned at first, but then, like, because they're so helpful with her daughter, she's like, oh, okay, they're fine now.
And then some customer comes in the shop, and Humphrey Bogart's or Joseph's like, I'll take this, don't worry. And he goes and he's selling this bald guy these hairbrushes and stuff, and this guy's like, and she's all amazed. He comes in, he gives her money. He's like, oh, I sold this, and I sold this, and I also sold him a hair tonic. And she's like, he's bald. And we find out that these people have these different abilities, these
skills.
Criminals. Yeah. I don't know what Albert's skill is, unless you said it's like the strength, because he doesn't really ever.
He
has a little friend, though.
Ah, yes.
Adolf.
The third angel.
Yes.
Or fourth angel.
Adolf is, he keeps in a little thing that looks like a little small house.
Right. And he's the cutest little cage I've ever seen.
Adolf is a little snake that's apparently incredibly deadly.
It's an incredibly deadly snake that you actually never see.
No.
You just see the little house that he's in, and you find out things that he does, but you don't ever actually see him. And I still loved him.
Yeah.
He's still a character.
But we find out that Humphrey is good at selling. I guess he's a con. I guess he's basically a con artist. He sells people stuff they don't need, and he's good at fixing books and forgery, which comes in handy later on. Mm-hmm. And Peter Ustinov is a safecracker and apparently also a murderer of wives. And also we find out that Joseph doesn't seem to have murdered anybody. He just seems to have gotten arrested for maybe forgeries, conning people, etc. But Albert also, we find out that he murdered his uncle.
Yes, I believe it was his uncle.
His uncle by hitting him 14 times on the head with a poker.
Yes. He asked him for money, and that's how he asked him.
Yeah. He asked him for money, and then he just hit him on the head with a poker and still didn't get any money, so that seems rather pointless. So anyhow, the girl wakes up. She has the suitcase. Why she has the suitcase for what she says she's going to do, I don't know.
But she wanted to run away.
I thought she wanted to kill herself.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I'm sorry.
Why do you need a suitcase?
That's true. You're right. You're right. Why does she have a suitcase? I didn't even think about that.
Why do you have a suitcase? Unless she wanted to put weight on herself and drown herself.
Possibly. That could have been
it. I just thought that was so strange. But she comes out and Albert's there, and she announces that she's going to go kill herself because Paul is going to wed some other woman. And Albert manages to say enough things to make her start feeling better. And then he starts to pay her some attention, and she gets very flirty with him. Would you find me attractive?
You really think I'm attractive?
And then they're standing next to each other, and she's like, are you sure you find me attractive? And then she goes, ooh.
Yeah, like he makes like a face and like a slight gesture with his arm, and you see her go, ooh.
And we know that we come to the conclusion that he's pinched her butt.
Yeah.
Because he was trying to pinch other women's butt before, so he's known to be a pincher on top of whatever else he did.
When I first watched it, I actually almost missed that part.
Yeah.
But then when I saw how she had acted afterwards, I was like, all right, what did I miss? And then I rewound it, and I was like, okay, that was cute.
Because she's like, oh, I better go do something else right now.
We need cups and saucers. Yes.
So what they're doing is they've been invited. Now they're doing all these nice things for the family, and they invite them to have Christmas dinner. So the three guys, they decide they're going to make this a really nice Christmas. They get all these decorations. They get all this nice stuff. Joseph goes and steals a turkey from somewhere, and then he's starting to cook it, and he's wearing this pink apron.
I thought that was great.
And he's wearing this pink apron, and Isabel comes in and says, oh, that pink really brings out your eyes. And Jules is like, Joseph, it does. It really brings out the brown in your eyes.
And he takes a flower and puts it in it.
Yeah, it's really, it sounds like not especially funny, but if you watch it, it's quite funny.
Yeah, Peter Ustinov, again, does a fantastic job. Just absolutely wonderful in that role.
Yeah, the way the guys all interact together is so incredibly cute.
I really do love the way their plan is that they eventually want to kill and rob these people.
Yes, that's
true. But they're so excited to get this Christmas going. Even you as the viewer at least I did, I kind of forgot that that was their plan. Because they just seem so excited about it. I love the joke that they want to get flowers. Oh, we'll go to the governor's. And then the joke is, oh, don't step on the grass. Well, what do you take me for? I just love that joke. Yeah. It was great.
Yeah. And then, so they go about steal. I mean, they get most of the stuff by thieving from around the town somehow or another.
Remember, the turkey followed Joseph against his will.
Yes.
That's the other joke I liked.
He did say that to Amelie. Amelie or whatever her name is. And they get all this beautiful Christmas dinner prepared for them. And it's really sweet. And probably to me, one of the most touching parts in the film is when she's putting the little angels on top of the tree. And this is when you can hear a little bit of the music. They're saying, oh, your angels, their wings are tattered. They don't have any halos. And she says something along the lines of, their wings are perfectly white. And their feathers are all intact. I can see their halos. And even though they say they come from heaven or something, although it just seems like maybe they came from the roof. And then she just gives them all a kiss on the cheek. And it's really, really a touching scene.
That is a sweet moment. I love that part.
It's hard not to tear up on that scene. It's really sweet. And then you have the mother playing the piano song that you were speaking of.
Yep. Sentimental Moments, I believe.
Sentimental Moments, which I guess was written for this film, but then it was actually turned into a pop hit by Eric Clapton.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. So
that's awesome.
Yeah.
No idea.
So as far as I know, that's the only recording ever of the actual song. Eric Clapton put it in his 2018 Christmas album.
Oh, wow. Oh, I'll have to check that out.
Interesting tie in there.
Were you surprised that they actually sang? I wasn't expecting that.
Oh, I forgot. Yeah, we forgot about the guy singing.
Yeah.
They sang something as well. It's a different song, I think, though.
I think it was called The Three Angels.
Yeah.
Or
not, I mean, they
like
didn't
that.
Sing it especially well. I think maybe they were supposed to not.
I thought it was pretty decent.
You
like,
did.
I was expecting it to sound a lot worse than it did, but I thought it was sweet. Jeremy Arnold mentions in the book when he talks about each Christmas movie has like that holiday moment, and he picked the Christmas dinner, them singing to the family, and then them charming the family, and then the family charming them with the wife singing sentimental moments. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the whole Christmas scene is very touching.
Yeah,
wonderful. It's the best part of the film, I think. They sing, and I mean, how often do you hear Humphrey Bogart singing a song?
Right.
I mean, I don't think that's very often.
I was so shocked. I was like, oh my God, that is Humphrey Bogart and he's singing.
Yeah. So, hey, I mean, there you go. And then, well, everything's so nice and idyllic, and they go to bed, and well, here comes the problem. Got Basil Rathbone pounding on the door, bam, bam. Well, I guess we forgot to say that he had come in on the ship originally.
They were
quarantined because of apparently the bubonic plague, which he completely disregards.
Right.
I've not come in contact with anybody that has the bubonic plague. I've just been on a ship for however long.
I've spent the last 8 hours convincing a witch doctor I have not come in contact with the bubonic plague.
Yes. So it sort of reminds you of some of the people in the COVID era.
So I thought this was a great part of the movie because up until that point, I think you as a viewer can think, oh, wait a minute, these are still convicts. Even though they're doing all these nice things, they could completely turn a whole leaf and end up doing all these horrible things. But no, Basil Rathbone shows up and you immediately know he's the antagonist.
He's the bad guy.
It's
the bad
wonderful.
Guy.
Actually, my favorite line is said right before he comes in. When Humphrey Bogart Joseph says, you know, we came here to rob them and that's what we're going to do. Beat their heads in, gouge their eyes out, cut their throats. As soon as we wash the dishes.
I know.
Like, I actually laughed out loud when I heard that. I was like, oh my God.
And then they show them washing the dishes.
Yeah, they actually are washing. Really you actually cute. Do see them wash the dishes. Yeah.
And they keep saying how they do keep in the times, oh yes, we have to remember to kill these people before
it's like,
we
can't
go.
Leave now. We got to clean up.
We got to do this and that, but then we got to kill these people. But anyhow, so Basil Rathbone comes in and he's very rude to everybody immediately.
Horribly
he's,
rude.
Yes, he's being very rude to the convicts. He's being very rude
to the family
Felix.
Itself. Yeah,
yeah. Everybody. He's rude to Isabel, and Isabel wants to talk to Paul, and Paul is also very
Paul's not what Isabel made him
not
to be.
You look at him, you're like, ew, yuck, we don't like
oh,
that
girl,
guy.
You can do better.
Yeah, no. And so she is very fond of him, so she's trying to talk to him. Andre's like, no, Paul, go to bed, and he's very bossy, and Paul's doing whatever he wants because Paul wants his money, you know.
Right.
And so right away, the convicts are on high alert, like, no, we don't like these guys. And they're trying to carry their suitcases.
They were a little depressed because the family was so kind to them.
Yeah,
they didn't have anybody to attack. Well, now that Andre's here, they're like, yes, we have somebody we can go after now. Yes, this is great.
And they're carrying the suitcases. And as they're walking, they keep hitting him. They keep hitting Andre in the head with a suitcase or they ran into him.
They do. It's another great performance from each of them.
It's very choreographed.
Yes.
Almost.
Yeah. They each find a way to irritate both Andre and Paul and get in their way. And oh yeah, it's wonderful to watch. Yeah.
It's really cute.
I will say though, another great line that I loved that Andre says, I believe he says it to Isabel. Oh yeah. Your opinion of me has no cash value.
Yes.
What a line.
Yes.
That's like an Ebenezer Scrooge line.
Yep.
I bet Charles Dickens was in the afterlife. Like, man, why didn't I write that line? So good.
And you know, it's kind of so hard to see Basil Rathbone in this mean character. I like him and it upsets me.
You know, I do like him, but you know what? He's really good at it.
Yeah, he is.
It's one of those, it's like, I don't like this character, but it's like, good job, Basil Rathbone.
Yeah,
like,
yeah. But
I respect.
I wish it could have been somebody I didn't like in the role. We could have put Errol Flynn in that role. Just kidding. Sorry, I had to get it in
that
somewhere.
That would be interesting.
Had to get it in somewhere. But anyhow, so they all retire for bed. But before Basil Rathbone, he wants to see the accounts first thing in the morning. And of course, that sends Felix into a tizzy. And he's all upset and worried. And also Amelie, they're all worried now. And so Humphrey Bogart's like, oh, I'll just fix up the books.
He's like, I got this.
Yeah.
Relax.
He's fixing up the books. And the whole time Felix is protesting because he's like, I'm honest. I don't want to do this. And this is We will add that this is still during the production code, so we don't want to let any of our good people do anything bad. So, of course, he's going to fix the books, and we get saved by that because Andre comes out and takes the books in his room with him.
Jules doesn't have the opportunity to change them.
Yeah, so Joseph can't change the books.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. Joseph can't change the books, so now Felix hasn't done anything wrong. So that's all production code stuff.
That's something I didn't even think about. Yeah.
I don't know if that happened. Maybe that happened in the play too. I don't know. But as soon as I thought, oh yeah, production code.
You're right. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyhow, he takes the books with him and he goes to sleep, and everybody just sort of go to sleep except the convicts, and they're like, well, what should we do? They're like, we have to kill Andre. And then they said, oh, but if we kill Andre, the family's going to question us and say, did you do this? And can we look them in the eye and say, we didn't do this? And everybody's, no, we can't do this, we can't kill them. And then the problem is solved because Andre comes out yet again, because he's like, what are all these losses on the accounts? And he's talking to the convicts, he's like, you've stolen all this stuff. And they're like, no, we didn't. And he grabs Adolf's case and he says, this is another thing you've stolen. And they're like, no, that's his personal property. And they don't state what it is, but they say, that's his personal property, give it back to him. And he said, it's not, I'm gonna go find out what this is. And they said, we're telling you again, that's his personal property, return it to him.
He can't figure out how to open it.
He can't
open
the cage. Yeah. So he's like, I'm going to go in my room and figure this out. And then this, I think, is really a funny part when they're all sitting at the table and they're like, somebody should rush in and warn him. Yeah. Somebody should rush in there and warn
him. Yeah, which one of us should do it?
Which one of us should rush in and warn him? Maybe you should do it. No, I don't think I could do it because of this. Well, how about if we cut cards for it? And then Joseph walks very, very slowly over to where the cards are, gets the cards, come back, put them on the table. Who should cut first? Well, I don't like to cut first. And then it's this big debate on who should cut first. And then finally they get around to the card cutting and Joseph loses. And then Joseph says, well, I guess I should rush in and warn him. And then he's like, eventually he gets up and he starts to go to the door. And why does he come back? I can't remember. He comes back with a reason why he had to come back. And I can't remember what it was.
Oh, I thought he went in and they said he went in quickly. He went in and then immediately came back out. And they asked him, you know, why didn't you tell him? And he's like, I don't need to.
No, he went to the door first and came back with a reason why he couldn't. Or some reason or excuse why he couldn't come in. And they said, no, go ahead. And I can't remember what it was, though.
Oh, I can't remember either. Yeah. Oh, geez.
Well, watch the movie and you can see for yourself.
There you go.
So anyhow, they go, but he eventually does go in the room. And like you said, he comes back out really quickly. And they're like, well, did you tell him? And he's like, nope, there's no need to. He already found out.
He found out.
Which we take to mean, of course, that he's dead. Andre is dead. And then
I will admit, again, another thing that shocked me. I was like, oh, okay. Yeah, they went there. All right.
But technically, the convicts didn't do it.
Oh, right. Well, no, I wasn't expecting them to actually commit murder, but I was just amazed that a death happened.
True, but they didn't show it on.
True, they didn't.
And they didn't show the body.
Yeah, you never see any bodies.
Yeah. So anyhow, he's dead, and I think we probably can't go much further with it because we're going to wind up getting into spoilers with
Pretty much, yeah.
Because there's other things that occur, but I don't want to say everything because then the whole story will be told.
It's true, yeah. Like after I watched it, I was like, oh gosh, how are we going to talk about the ending?
But I mean, the thing about this film is that it's just really sweet, really heartwarming, and the production code, I'm sure, was satisfied by the ending.
Right.
We'll say that.
I would say so.
Which the ending is very absurd, but
I was actually a little surprised by the complete ending.
Yes.
What their final decision is.
Yes. But again, I do think that's because of the production code.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then again, like I said, I haven't seen the play, so I don't know. This film was remade in 1989, very loosely.
I'm pretty sure it only took the name and the basic concept, and that's
themes.
It. Yeah.
Robert De Niro and Sean Penn, so interesting.
Have you ever seen that? I haven't.
No.
Yeah, I have no desire, really.
No, this film is enough to see. If you want to see this concept,
this is the one to see. Out of the two of them, this is the one to definitely see.
And Were No Angels grossed $3 million at the box office in 1955. It was the 34th highest grossing film in the U.S.-Canada market. And that's about all I have to say about were no angels, what would you like to say it?
Well, I've said so many things that have surprised me about this movie. It's like, this might be a little bit of a conceited thought, but I've seen enough movies that usually when you watch them, you get an idea of how it's going to go. This movie pleasantly surprised me the whole way through. So many things happened, different situations, the way the characters changed and evolved. And I just found it really refreshing and I found it wonderful. And it's like I said earlier, I wish there were another set of movies revolving these three guys doing different things together. I would totally have watched that. This was absolutely wonderful. And if I could pick one word to describe this movie, I would say charming.
Yeah,
this
I would say delightful.
Incredibly charming. Yeah.
It's delightful. It's charming. It's heartwarming. It's a Christmas movie. It's a perfect Christmas movie. As a matter of fact, it's just as good as any other Christmas movie out there. And it's probably more funny than the others.
And I would also like to add, if your partner, girlfriend, boyfriend, if they're not a Christmas or classic movie person, show them this movie.
Yeah, because
they'll like it.
They have tough guy Humphrey Bogart. They have tough guy Aldo Ray.
It's like, ladies, if your man wants to watch Die Hard, make him watch this.
Yes, this is way better than Die Hard.
Yes. Do you think, real quick, I know we're kind of getting to the end. Do you think there's any particular reason why you think people have forgotten this?
I think it never really made much of an impression. First of all, I think it was kind of, it's in a weird classification. It is a Christmas movie that's not very Christmassy.
That's a dark comedy.
Yes.
That was kind of my thoughts. It's like, I think that's probably why, because when people think Christmas movie, they think White Christmas, lightheartedness, musical, you know.
Street.
And this is like the complete opposite.
Yeah. So, I mean, I just think maybe the classification isn't there. That people really, they don't think of this as a Christmas movie. They don't think of this movie. And then a regular movie, they wouldn't think of this movie either. So, I mean, it's just strange when you have such a famous dynamic actor like Humphrey Bogart that this is not more talked about.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
I mean, you have a major star in this film and you have a major director on this film too. So it is odd.
Yeah.
But so this is why we're telling you.
Absolutely.
That you need to go see this film.
Yes.
Especially in the Christmas. I would say see it in the Christmas season.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It's Christmas today. I mean, obviously, you probably see if you can stream it on your TV.
What I ended up doing is I actually think it might be available on YouTube, but I ended up renting it from Amazon Prime. Money worth spent. It was like $4. Totally worth it.
Yeah. And if not on Christmas, but you can always try to look in your local libraries.
That too.
You can pick up a copy at your local libraries. But yeah, this is a film you want to see. We highly recommend. We do have to give it a star rating, 1 out of 5.
I'm going to go with 4. Yeah, my only issues with it were pacing, but I felt certain scenes went on a little too long, except the scene where they're going to tell Andre about the snake. That was perfectly
that
meant
was
to
hilarious.
Be slow,
it's
but
so
there are
funny.
Other parts that go a little too slow for my taste, but honestly, that's the only thing I had an issue with. That's it.
Yeah, I give it a 4 as well, because the acting is very good in this film, excellent in this film. Even Aldo Ray, who I don't think of as a very heavy-hitting actor, is really perfect
He's
in this
perfect
film.
For
this
that
is
role.
His sort of role. It works for him. I penalize it because I just think it looks so much like a set. It's so obviously like a set. It's a little play-like. It's a little stagey, a little bit blocking looking like.
If nobody had told me, I would say, yeah, this is definitely based on a play.
Yeah.
Just from looking
so,
at it.
So, I mean, those are the detriments, but I mean, it just... there's so many great things in the film. Just the story itself is so beautiful and so charming. The acting is so wonderful. And it's just humorous, funny, cute, charming. It gives you a great feeling at the end. And, you know, that does just overrule everything else.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, yeah, I can overlook other
overlook
things.
Yeah, the sets. Yeah.
Yeah. Doesn't matter. I would, like, I watched it. I wanted to watch it again. And then it was another day later. And I was like, I'm going to watch it again.
It's the sort of film you can definitely watch over and over again.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yep. So anyway, I want to thank you so much, Debbie, for being our guest today.
Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to do this. This was great.
Yeah. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And so anyhow, for Silver Screen Time Machine, Wendy's Classic Film Review, this is Wendy saying goodbye. Thank you for listening to our podcast today. Please don't forget to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and TikTok. And please leave us a comment or a review on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. Intro and outro music composed by Heidi Engel. Artwork by Tyler Birch. Produced and edited by Wendy Wittick. Recorded at PCTV Studios, Pittsburgh, PA. See you next time.